Have a seat. Good morning. I had conflicting notes back in my chambers that said Lancaster High School, and up here it says Oshkosh North. Which high school do we have here?
Maybe you have both. There's a lot of people here.
Who do we have from what high school?
Oshkosh over here.
Apparently neither. Oshkosh North. All right, this one wins. Oshkosh North, can you please stand up? We'd like to say hi to you.
Oh, wonderful.
Good group. Great to have you here today. Good travel day. That's nice, too. Hopefully you enjoy being with us. Justice Karofsky will take time to meet with you if you have time for her after our second oral argument this morning. But welcome to the court. Nice to see you. Go ahead and have a seat. Colleen State versus Michael Fernanich, 21 AP 462 CR. Could I please have your appearances? All right, good morning. 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes on rebuttal, right? Okay, go ahead and proceed.
It pleases the court. I'm Colleen Marion, and I represent Michael Fremnick. On the night of September 30th, 2017, Mr. Fremnick was taken into custody as a result of a joint effort between Langlade County deputies and Oneida County deputies to apprehend him for a joyride that began in Langlade County and crossed the county line into Oneida. From the moment he was taken into custody, Mr. Fremnick was locked up for 433 days until he pled guilty under a consolidated case number to charges from both counties and read-in charges from both counties. The circuit court was right to grant him pretrial credit for 433 days toward all three counts of conviction, including count one, which originated in Langlade County. These days were in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed, satisfying the requirement of 973.1551A. The Court of Appeals decision reversing the credit on count one was erroneous and should be reversed.
I want to ask you a question about bond. So as I'm looking at 973.1551A, the language I'm looking at is receiving a credit for his sentence for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct. And the Langlade count, count number one, the en bloc, he received a signature bond. So I'm having a hard time understanding how he was in custody on that count if he received a signature.
Well, he was never released from custody. His signature on the bond form was just that, a signature on a bond form. He was never released from custody. I think that
he could have been because he was in on a signature bond, and had he posted the cash in Oneida County, Langlade, he would have been released. I just don't understand how he was in custody on that count.
But he never was released from custody. He didn't post that bond, and so this is different than, you know, the one case that was cited by the state where the signature bond was dispositive. In that case, the defendant actually walked free out of the jail on his signature bond, and I maintain that that matters. That makes a difference.
So can I assess one hypothetical?
Sure.
Okay. So let's imagine that he was in. The facts are the same here. He's in on one count. He's got a signature bond. The other two, he's in on. I think he was in on 10 grand cash total, I think, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So let's say he sits for 10 days and then he's able to post the 10 grand cash total, and then he's out, okay? Under your analysis, would he get credit for those 10 days on the first count?
In that situation, when was the signature bond imposed?
Say it all happened in the same. Let's make it simple. all happened on the same day. He got a signature bond on day one, and he got $10,000 cash on counts four and five on day one. And 10 days later, he posts the 10 grand and he's out.
In that situation, he would be, I guess I'm having a little of a hard time with the hypothetical just because I think it's really important here that Langlade County delayed filing for so long. There were 3 months that passed in between, his arrest and then the filing of charges. And so when I try to think about whether the imposition of bond really forges a factual connection, I have a hard time with that because it leaves so much to the charging decision by the prosecutor. I don't think that the imposition of the bond is a factual connection. I think it's a procedural connection. And here I don't think the signature bond matters.
Because it's custody. You're reading the statute to say in custody, and he was never released, so therefore it's custody. The statute doesn't say in custody in a certain jurisdiction or in custody for custody. Is that how you get there?
Yes, in custody, the factual connection has to be behind, between the custody and the sentence. And I think when you focus on the reason why he was in custody, now I want to address the issue with me using the word arrest, okay, because maybe that was poor word choice. But what matters more than the reason why somebody's taken into custody? We're asking what was the reason for their custody and was that in connection with their sentence? I believe that the state's focus on the charging and the bonds is what's really the procedural connection in this case. But even if the court has concerns about the signature bond, the court should still affirm the circuit court, either because the Floyd holding on reading credit applies in this case, or because the charges were part of a single course of conduct. In State versus Floyd, this court held that a defendant was entitled to sentence credit for time spent in custody in connection with a read-in charge that was dismissed and read in as part of the plea. The court found that this satisfied the sentence credit statute's requirement or provision that a person is entitled to credit for time spent in custody related to an offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced, which is in the second statute of 973.1551A. In this case, not only were charges from Oneida County dismissed and read in, the cases became one through the process of consolidation. Since Floyd, I would say there's been some refinement so that maybe using the word bright line is not quite right. Because in Strzokowski, this court further refined the definition of read-in charges to clarify that not all read-ins are deemed admitted. Even so, in this case, it is unambiguous that Michael Fremnick admitted to the conduct in the read-in charges. This is because when a person applies for consolidation, they are, by virtue of the statute, admitting to the conduct. That's in 973.091. It's also unambiguously clear here that the circuit court relied on the conduct underlying all of the Oneida County charges. The sentencing judge was discussing the entire incident that night, starting in Langlade, ending in Oneida. I also think it would be an arbitrary result for Mr. Fremnick to be entitled to the sentence credit had Oneida County been dismissed entirely instead of him taking responsibility for some of the charges there. I think that gets to the state's argument, basically that he already got this void credit on counts four and five, and so he shouldn't get it again on count one. The state's talking about lost credit from the case where the charges were read in. But this credit is lost credit. If this court takes away the credit on count one, the credit on the other charges is meaningless because his sentence will be 433 days longer on count one. Remember,
let me ask, of what import is that?
Here we have concurrent sentences. Each of the three sentences is 18 months in length. Counts 4 and 5 is the pursuant to the Court of Appeals opinion, thus is 18 months minus 133 days sentence credit for 4 and 5. Count 1, no sentence credit. It's the full 18 months. What import is that there will be no benefit of counts 4 and 5 sentence credit under the Court of Appeals opinion?
The import of the fact that it will add 433 days to his overall sentence is that the purpose of the sentence credit statute is to afford fairness by applying in a wide range set of circumstances to ensure that a person not spend more time in custody than the judge actually imposed in their sentence. Here, Mr. Fremnick would not serve 18 months in and 2 years out as the judge imposed. He would serve 18 months plus 433 days in custody, apparently because he signed the signature bond or because Langlade County didn't add more cash.
What is your requested holding? What would you want us to exactly say about what the statute means? And if you could add to that the cases that, you know, we may need to overturn if we were to accept your position, if you could summarize that in a paragraph or so, it would be great, because that's what we have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the court could reach the correct result a few different ways, but I understand that an interesting issue for the court is the statutory construction issue on course of conduct. Course of conduct cannot mean specific act, because the word conduct means act. So a course of conduct must be something more than a specific act. I do want to address the, of course, the fact that we have Tuescher, this Court of Appeals decision in Tuescher, that has stated that the definition is specific act, and that's a published decision of the Court of Appeals. I think the court can distinguish Tuescher, and if not, should withdraw or modify the language defining course of conduct the way it does. I think Tuescher can be distinguished because it is really a case about how sentence credit should be applied when there are more than one concurrent sentences that are imposed at different times. And in that situation, the Beetz rule applies. And the Beetz rule is that the start of any sentence severs the connection between the custody and any other case. Tuescher fits well under the Beetz ruling, and therefore I don't believe needs overturned. I understand the argument that how can course conduct mean something different when we're talking about the pretrial context versus sentencing.
Can you back up for a minute? If that rule is accepted, why doesn't that have some import in the way here, like the time frame of when that happens? Why wouldn't that be relevant in a case like this? Because if your argument is that, sentence is ultimately imposed for this broader course of conduct, mm-hmm. why does the time frame of a sentence in a different jurisdiction matter, or a separate set of charges, if you interpret course of conduct to be so broad? How is that rule consistent with that interpretation?
The proposed definition of it being a series of acts?
No, I mean, you know, I think everybody can. It depends on how widely you interpret that, right? A course of conduct maybe it's a series of acts, maybe it's a number of different acts stacked together. However you want to phrase it, that's maybe of less import than your argument here. The course of conduct includes this multi-county, you know, crime spree. That was done in a relatively short period of time and in the same types of things. But if the argument is that there's a severing that happens at some point, how is that consistent with your argument when the statute just says, you know, if sentence was imposed, you know, you're being held in, you know, in custody in connection with that course of conduct? I'm just trying to square how those rules fit together as opposed to a bunch of patchwork things.
That the custody and the connection was severed, or are you asking when does one, you know, course of conduct end?
Well, yes, and you're putting like a time frame on it when there's a separate sentence or acknowledging that. So I'm just curious how that all fits together. I'm looking for some holistic way to make sense of the statute in light of what we've said about it, too.
I hope I'm going to answer your question, but please stop me if I'm not.
Sure, that's great.
I do think, you know, the state's point about, you know, looking at course of conduct, and I think they use the word blinkered, but just looking at those three words instead of the surrounding words, I disagree that the surrounding words are limiting, but it is, you know, the point is well taken. In the sentence that we're applying here, the first sentence of the credit statute states, for any other sentence arising out of the same course of conduct. And in Tuescher, the court was not interpreting that phrase at all. The court was interpreting the second sentence of 973.1551A, which discusses the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. So I can understand the discomfort in having course of conduct mean something different, but I think we can find that those two provisions in the statute mean something different, especially because when we're talking about a Beats-type situation, the court's been very clear that we, as soon as the sentence starts running, we should be concerned that that custody has been severed.
So you're not asking, were you done, Justice Hagedorn?
Go ahead.
So I'm not hearing you ask us to overturn, is it Tuescher?
I think it's Tuescher.
Tuescher? Okay, we'll go with Tuescher. I'm not hearing you ask us to overturn it, number one. Number two, I also hear you saying that that it would be okay to interpret course of conduct differently pre and post. And I got to tell you, as a judge who sat on the bench in circuit court and had to deal with sentence credit, like when I read the briefs and I realized that there was a letter from the Department of Corrections about sentence credit, my heart started to beat super, super fast because every circuit judge gets those letters all the time. And I thought, oh, I thought I was past that, and I'm not. I had that same feeling again. So it's really complicated, right? I mean, it can be, like, so nuanced. And I appreciate the DOC letters. They were usually right that there had been a mistake, and I was happy to clear that up. But it's super, super complicated, and I really cannot imagine having what two different tests would do. I mean, it would make, a very, very complicated situation even more so. Which brings me back to my first question. Why aren't you asking us just to get rid of Tuescher?
I think all that needs to be applied in terms of Tuescher is that it's a Beats case. I don't think there's like a specific case-by-case analysis that needs to be applied there. I think it's just Tuescher fits with Beats. When a sentence starts running, it severs the connection, and that's a rule that circuit courts apply every day to sentence credit. I think Tuescher reached the correct result because of Beats. I think Tuescher was, you know, contending with a little bit of language in Beats about, well, you know, these are not related at all. The sentences in Beats were, no one was arguing they were related. And the court in Beats said, well, and that's not our situation. Maybe it's a little different if they're truly, you know, related or identical, was the language in Beats. So Tuescher was contending with that, but I think since then, really entrenched, and I think that Tuescher just fits with that.
But we would clarify, you'd ask us to clarify the language in Tuescher, because doesn't Tuescher go a little bit too far with this whole idea of a single act as opposed to course of conduct, at least in how it's described?
I do think Tuescher went a little far in the definition of course of conduct as specific act, in part because it didn't, you know, undertake a plain meaning interpretation of the statute, but also because I don't think that definition follows from the cases it relied on. that language-specific act, the only time it was used was in Tuscher. I don't necessarily think that specific act is all that easy to apply either. The only time that there's been a decision from the Court of Appeals or this court actually applying that definition is State versus Zoronis. And in that case, the Court of Appeals found that the following facts were the same specific act. Police entered the defendant's home, found drugs and drug paraphernalia. She resisted arrest, and later her child tested positive for methamphetamine. The Court of Appeals found that to be the same specific act. In this case, I take the state's argument to be that counts 4 and 5 may be separate specific acts. Count 4, so first of all, count 3 in Langlade County was him in the third truck. As soon as he crossed the county line, we're on count 4. Same truck, driving the same truck, just crosses the line. Okay. And that's operating a motor vehicle without owner's consent. Count 5 is the fleeing and eluding in that same truck, driving that same truck at the exact same time, and then it became a new specific act at some point. And the only thing I can think of is that he had a new thought in his head. I'm driving this car, and now I'm going to drive it in a way to elude.
So are you're understanding the state's argument to be that count 1 is different from count 4 and from count 5?
I read the state's argument to be that counts 1, counts 4, and counts 5 are different courses of conduct, but that counts 4 and 5 get the credit because of the cash bond. And that just really brings me back to the fact that I just think this case is really simple, and the signature bond didn't sever the connection between the custody and the sentence on count 1. I think to take away this credit on count 1 would be to either penalize Mr. Fremnick for being poor and not being able to post $10,000 bond, or penalize him for being unsavvy in the sense that he signed a piece of paper, a signature bond, not knowing that it could put him in the signature bond trap.
So many times at the trial court level, someone was in on other charges, and actually the defense might actually argue that cash bond be imposed instead of a signature bond, so that they get credit. Here, does it make any difference if it's cash or signature bond under your argument?
I don't think it matters because he never got out of custody. What matters is that
right,
he was in
custody.
Right,
but it does matter. A signature bond isn't holding you. The cash bond is holding you, right? So that really reads into non-existence the distinction between a signature and a cash bond. So long as you're in custody, doesn't matter how, doesn't matter if you're being held on this case or not, you get credit. That's different than anything that's ever been done in my practice as a trial judge or as a lawyer.
I'm not familiar with any case that holds that a signature bond being imposed is the dispositive fact.
Signature bond keep that person in custody?
He was in custody because of the crimes he committed on September 30th, and he never got out, and his sentences were in connection with that custody. I don't think that the types of bonds are a factual connection. I believe that it's a procedural connection. And I think
I just said interesting. Oh, okay. I mean, then those arguments are of no purpose, really. Once bond is set in one case, you're done. That counts for everything that happens later that might be part of a global plea agreement or not.
I believe it's different if the person's released on their signature bond. If they walk out of custody, they're not in custody anymore.
Right.
They're not getting credit either way then because they're not behind bars.
Right. That's why it's important to either have cash bond or not on those subsequent cases if you want credit for them. At least that's how it used to work in the old days.
I will note that he was uncounseled at his initial appearance. He did not have an attorney to whisper into his ear, maybe you shouldn't sign this piece of paper. You're not going anywhere. You're indigent. You've had a $10,000 cash bond for the last 3 months.
Is that your argument? He didn't have counsel to ask for cash bond, and that would have made a difference?
I guess under the state's argument, it would have made a difference. Doesn't make a difference under my position. He was behind bars this whole time. He didn't get out on a signature bond. He didn't get out on any bond.
So what my facility was he in? Was he in Oneida?
He was in the Oneida County Jail. I think Carter makes it very clear it doesn't matter where somebody physically is. You know, Carter was in Illinois, and he got credit for his Wisconsin sentence.
Why didn't he have counsel? This is a significant hearing, right? This is a part of the stage. This is a significant stage. He has a right to have an attorney. Why didn't he have one?
I have to be limited in how I answer that because this record is not the complete record from the circuit court.
Okay, based on the record, can you answer it?
Based on CCAP, he didn't have an attorney, and that's all I really can say based on this record. I wish he did have an attorney. It might have turned out really different for him.
The plea agreement also might have turned out different if he had an attorney. That could have all been taken care of.
Well, did he have an attorney by the time he entered his plea?
He did, and attorney John Padgham had taken over the case at that point from his first trial attorney, and he did lament. You know, unfortunately, we had some inexperienced lawyers on both sides, and this really took way longer than it should have.
Okay, but is that the rule you're asking us to develop? If you've had inexperienced or no counsel, then you get more sentence credit than someone who doesn't? I mean, it's up to the judge to decide if they're going to hold you on cash bond, and the judge knows that means you get credit if you're in on cash bond. You can answer the question, but your light's on.
I can't tell you why the signature bond was imposed because that's not in the record.
Okay, thanks.
And I think it matters what the judge's intent was. Thank you.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. I'd like to start with the facts of the case again because I think it's necessary to understand the counts on which credit is available and counts that they are not available. So one night, Michael Fermanage stole a truck in the town of Anago in Langlade County and drove to the Thirsty Bear Tavern in the town of Peck. There, he abandoned the first truck, stole another, and drove it to Fisher's Bar in the town of Parrish. He then abandoned the second truck, took a third, and drove it into Oneida County, where he was detected by law enforcement, leading them on a high-speed chase that ended when he lost control of the truck and landed it in a creek.
Counsel, as part of those facts of the case, I found it interesting. He must have been in a hurry because, according to the timing, he stole three trucks in less than 38 minutes. Am I correct on that?
I'm not sure that you're correct. I will take your word for that.
Well, don't take my word because what do I know? But I'm taking it from the brief of your opposing counsel that indicates that at 9:40 p.m., the person that owned the first truck saw him take the first truck and then that's 9:40, and then at 10:18, Oneida County was aware that a third truck had been stolen. So I didn't check the record sites of your opposing counsel, but that's the time set forth in your opposing counsel's brief.
The entire criminal spree took about 2 hours, is my understanding, in part because, and I'm not say that it took 2 hours.
You know, it's interesting to me that you use the term spree, because that's exactly, when I first looked at this case, I thought, well, this is quite a spree, right? And spree, actually, to me, connotes more of a course of conduct. I'm concerned that your emphasis on specific acts reads out of the statute the word course. So can you respond to alleviate me from this heavy concern that I bear?
Sure. I would be happy to. First, course of conduct does not necessarily mean a series of acts. And in fact, this court addressed the meaning of course of conduct for the first time in Boettcher, and it did so at great length. It concluded that course of conduct had the same meaning, practically speaking, as crime. It wasn't intended to expand the meaning of course of conduct, I'm sorry, the meaning of the availability of credit beyond that provided in the model penal code on which it was based.
Didn't Boettcher, though, involve consecutive sentences rather than concurrent like we have here?
It did. That was the primary issue that was decided in that case. But there was a secondary argument that was made by the defendant in that case that the choice of course of conduct somehow bore on the question of whether there was dual credit available for consecutive sentences. I don't know exactly how it did, but that led this court to press the meaning of the statute at length. And Tesher, the heart of Tesher really is that extended quote from the Boettcher decision that addresses the meaning of course of conduct.
Counsel, I'm sorry, could you address the relevance of the signature bond? Obviously, there's been some argument
about
that.
Sure. I was going to go back to that. Maybe I should have started there. Bond status, of course, is very important to whether credit is available. Now, if someone is unable to post cash bail, they're unable to make cash bail, that, by definition, is custody in connection with that count. But if they do post a signature bond, typically credit is not available because they're not in custody on that count. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule, and the most famous of that is Hintz. And in Hintz, it holds that when there is custody, when someone posts a signature bond on a charge, but there is also a hold, a probation hold or a supervision hold that's placed for the same conduct, credit is available even though a signature bond has been posted. But that's a narrow exception, and this court would actually be providing another exception to that rule. Now, Justice Kurofsky raised an important point throughout her questioning, and that was, this is really complicated stuff. And I think that a rule like the rule in Tesher is straightforward and easy to apply. And focusing on the specific acts. And by the way, it's not a specific act, it is specific acts. It is the acts from which you can derive a charge, might be multiple different charges. It has to be multiple different charges because it may be that at a different point there will be a plea agreement to which someone pleads to a lesser charge, to a different charge than the charge defense. So specific act does, specific acts it is, not specific act.
If that's so clear-cut, how do you get to state v. Zahronis? I think...
I'm not going to defend Zahronis. What I will say is that it was poorly argued in the Court of Appeals. The state did not argue the course of conduct issue there. Had we argued it, I believe that the outcome would have been different. But you'll see, if you read Zahronis, it says the state does not contest that the course of conduct issue. We only argued the signature bond issue.
So how do you square, then, the specific act language with the statutory language? I mean, we are supposed to undertake a plain meaning reading. That is our job initially to do. And I do not know how you get away from course of conduct. And I know Justice Ann Walsh Bradley asked you, I find it interesting you use the word spree. I did look that up. That's pretty well a definition of a course of conduct. And so it's a spell or sustained period of unrestrained activity of a particular kind. So how do we, you're asking us to get away from the language of course of conduct by saying specific act. And how do we do that?
One of my primary arguments, if not my primary argument, is course of conduct is modified for which sentence was imposed. And for which sentence is imposed naturally lends itself to a more limited reading of course of conduct, because sentence is not imposed for the series of acts that may surround or may precede the specific acts constituting an offense or relating to an offense.
Okay, and here we have concurrent sentences And all of it was taken into consideration. All of it was consolidated. So how does your argument work in this particular case? For which he was sentenced was all of it together. He was given a concurrent sentence of the 18 months on each of the counts, consolidated, all considered at the same time for purposes of sentencing.
They are considered at the same time, but he's sentenced on three different counts. And he's sentenced on the first count, which is stealing the first truck in Langley County. He's sentenced on count four, which is driving at least 40 minutes later in Oneida County, leading on a high-speed chase through Langley County and count five. So those are separate offenses for which sentence was imposed.
Are you viewing four and five separately?
No, I think that they're very similar. They overlap, obviously. I mean, it's the same. He continues to commit count four while he's eluding the officer. They overlap.
It would be an interesting concept if we decided to equate crime spree with course of conduct such that you received credit. I mean, I can think of crime sprees that last for a number of days and they finally catch the person, or a crime spree that starts out with a robbery or a burglary and then advances to far more significant, horrible things that might happen within the home. And then, maybe they steal a car. I'm thinking of the crime sprees that I've dealt with as a judge, where there are a variety of things, including multi-county chases, and then shots being fired, and someone being hospitalized, and then the person attempting to kill a law enforcement officer, and then they escape the hospital, and then they carjack a little old lady's car who's out to let her dog out before she takes off in her car, and then have multi-county car chases involving multiple victims after that. That's a crime spree. That's a real case, by the way. We could go on and on and on. In no group of facts would someone think that each individual crime that has been committed should be considered based upon one bond that might be set in one case at one point in time.
Right. Right, this is why Fermanage's interpretation is not workable, frankly. It's because where is the cutting point? Where is the cutting off point here for determining when something is a course of conduct?
Counsel, but if we buy your argument, mm-hmm. doesn't he get imposed an additional 433 days on counts four and five that the court did not give him?
Yes, and appropriately so.
You don't think that's a problem?
No, it's not a problem under this court's case law. In Alandis Johnson, this court addressed that issue. There's a court of appeals case called Ward, which is discussed in the briefs, in which it essentially says that whenever you have concurrent sentences, if a sentence is concurrent, even if it doesn't relate to the course of conduct for which sentence is imposed, credit should be granted. So that case was overruled or disavowed by this court in Alandis Johnson, and that rule requires that each count satisfy the requirements of 973-155. You can't, just because a sentence is imposed concurrently doesn't mean that you get essentially free credit on that sentence. And it's not unfair either because, I'm sorry, Bradley.
No.
And it's not unfair either because the person who receives concurrent sentences already receives the benefit of concurrent sentences. Now here, in fact, if Fermanage were sentenced to consecutive sentences, he would have received credit for this custody only on count four. He wouldn't have received it on count five. And so here he already receives some benefit from the fact that he has concurrent sentences, even though he's not receiving credit on count one.
Why? I'm not understanding that four and five reasoning. Because he was in on $10,000 on both of those.
Go ahead. Right. No, if sentences, well, you know this from being a trial court judge, if sentences are imposed consecutively, the credit only goes to the first sentence in time, okay? So the first sentence in time to which he would receive credit, under my analysis at least, would be count four. So he would receive credit on count four, he would receive no credit on five, and of course no credit on one.
But that goes back to the question I just asked you a couple minutes ago when I asked you whether or not you're viewing count one separate from count four and five. I was asking you if you view count four separate from count five. I took your answer to mean you don't, but now I'm hearing you argue something differently, because if four and five are part of the same course of conduct and he gets concurrent time for four and five.
The hypothetical, as I just, as we were talking about it here, was what would happen if consecutive sentences were imposed in this case. It doesn't have to do with whether the course of conduct is the same for course for count four and count five. If you have consecutive sentences, I'm just saying that you only get credit on one of the counts. Okay. I'm just saying that I hear the fairness arguments here about how he's denied credit by not having the credit applied to count one. I'm saying he's already received a considerable benefit by being sentenced to concurrent sentences.
So I'm more concerned with how your test applies, and this gets to what Justice Kurofsky was asking. I don't understand what is a specific act. It's certainly not described in the statute in any way, shape, or form, because it says course of conduct. So if you want us to apply this one case that talked about specific act that cited to no other cases, Tesher or Tuescher, how does that work in the future? We're talking about making this easy for circuit court judges. I'm not even sure if you're saying four and five are each a specific act or not. You keep going back and forth.
I'm saying specific acts.
So are they each specific acts? What would happen? I mean, whatever hypothetical you want to think of, is four a specific act? Is five a specific act? Or are they a course of conduct together? What are they?
Certainly the facts overlap there.
You said that, but you got to answer my question.
Oh, no, does one overlap too? I can't tell if you're trying to thread a needle here.
No, I'm not trying to thread a needle,
frankly.
So are
they the same course of conduct or aren't they? Four and five. What's your answer?
I will say, if you're making me choose, I will say no.
There's specific acts.
There's specific acts.
This is the problem with the test. So how does that work in real-life world where you stole a car in one county, you're driving the same car into another county, and you're saying that's a different act?
You're coming up with a hypothetical here in which credit might be available under Tesher because the specific acts are arguably the same.
Okay, so, but just... I'm super confused, and maybe it's possible it's just me, and it's Monday morning. I only had one cup of coffee. This is what I'm hearing you say. There is an Omblock in Langley County. That's separate act. There is an Omblock in Oneida County. That's a separate act, count four. There's an eluding in Oneida County. That's a separate act.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's how you're looking at this.
Yes.
It's hard because you don't want to, I don't think. I think you kind of said
that over here. Frankly, it's a hypothetical that I didn't. It's a hypothetical I didn't anticipate, because this case deals with whether he's entitled to credit against count one, not whether he's entitled to credit against count four, count five. It's undisputed that he's entitled.
But I'm trying to figure out what your analysis is, and I don't understand how, if you can separate out count one, I don't understand how you're slicing and dicing this.
The custody on four and five, undisputedly, is related to the course of conduct in four and five, because he's charged with those offenses in that county, and he fails to pay cash bond in that county. So, of course, he's entitled to credit on four and five. He's not entitled to credit on one, because he's posted a signature bond for one, and there isn't another demand on his custody like an active warrant that is meaningful in this case. So, for instance, in Carter, there was custody in Illinois for Wisconsin charges. There was a warrant that was issued after those charges were issued by Wisconsin. He was detained in Illinois and held in Illinois for up to 90 days under the Interstate Detainer Act because of his charges in Wisconsin. And that's very distinguishable from this case, because there is no demand on his liberty.
So is that your best argument? Is the signature bond your best argument? Or is the specific acts, course of conduct, Tesher your best argument? Or do you have to win on both of those?
I win on both. And it's important to remember that that bond status does correlate very closely to the course of conduct analysis.
You know, counsel, he's confined in the Oneida County Jail. The Oneida County jailer is not going to let him out. He doesn't care what it says in Langhague County, whether it's a signature bond or whether it's a cash bond. He's not letting him out because he hasn't met the terms of what Oneida County required. So I don't see why the signature bond is such a big deal in this case. It makes no difference. Zero. So why should we say, well, he had a signature bond, so he doesn't get any credit? I don't think it makes any difference because Langhague County is not the driving factor on his custody. It's Oneida County, which is where he's locked up, right?
Sure.
And Oneida County could care less whether Langhague County had a signature bond or a cash bond. They're still not going to let him out, right?
Yeah, there's no question that he's in custody.
I don't see why the signature bond is a big deal in this case. It may be in some cases, but I sure don't see it in this case.
Well, when a signature bond is filed, the person is typically not in custody on that count.
Well, they can usually walk out the door, but this guy wasn't going anywhere. He was not in a jail that had given him, for which a jailer could accept a signature bond.
Right.
Right? And he couldn't meet the cash bail. And he was in, that's the facility he was in. So I think since he's in a different facility, a facility that would not honor whatever Langhague County chose because he couldn't meet Oneida County's requirements, I just think we're kind of focusing on something that really doesn't make much difference in this case.
Well, there's no dispute that he was in custody. The whole question is whether that custody is in connection with each of the charges and whether it satisfies the legal test for credit under each of the charges. And
setting aside what the courts have said as far as interpreting the statute, if we're looking at the plain language of the statute, the offender shall be given credit toward the service of his sentence for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. So if, to answer Justice Rogenczak's question, he was never in custody for count one in Langhague County because he signed a signature bond. So applying the plain language, he couldn't possibly get sentence credit. So I think that's actually the pivotal reason, among other reasons, why he wouldn't be entitled to credit. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't disagree. I think that's well said. That's better said than I just attempted to say it. He's not entitled to credit under the plain language of the statute. You need to satisfy the test for custody. You need to satisfy the test for the connection, the in-connection requirement, in order to receive credit on each count. You have to satisfy it on each count in order to be entitled to it.
Okay, that's doesn't it?
I'm sorry, could I haven't had a chance to ask any questions yet. I also look at this based on the facts. There were three separate thefts. There were three separate victims. Somebody's car was stolen, then it was abandoned. Somebody else's car was stolen, then it was abandoned. I guess maybe this is more of a question for your friend on the other side in rebuttal, but I'm having a hard time understanding how to apply the test proposed by the defense that would take account of these different offenses. It seems like then any offenses for which somebody is charged and convicted, if they happen to be sentenced at the same time, then that's just one big course of conduct. But that, I don't see how that takes account of the separate victims here and the choices that the defendant made three separate times to commit actually four times, because then there was the eluding the officer, yet another offense.
Right, right. The excellent argument for why we should apply a test that's narrowly focused based on the specific acts. Now, it's not the specific act, but it's the specific acts. It's those acts that give rise to the individual charges, each set of acts that gives rise. So stealing the car in Langhague County, one, and driving the third truck into Oneida County, another, eluding an officer, another, and custody, as well as the connection needs to be satisfied in each case for credit to be available. I should say that course of conduct does not necessarily mean a series of acts either. That's not necessarily the case. And in fact, this court has said so In a case that's not cited in either party's brief, but I found recently.
It's Counsel, well, I'll let you finish, then I have a follow-up.
Okay, yeah, I think that it's really relevant here to the reasonableness of the state's interpretation. The case name is NEM by Kreshak v. Strigel. It's 208 with second one at page 8. It's a 1997 case.
208, what's the page number?
Oh, I'm sorry, page 1 it starts at, and the pinpoint site is 8. Act, in that case, it dealt with the meaning of the word act in the statute that imposes criminal liability on parents for the criminal acts of their children. So that should, I was going to say that should key up the ears of the audience here. Anyway.
I'm watching their ears. I don't know.
No, okay. I tried. That what this court says there is that, and I quote, the most appropriate definition of act is something done or performed, and that's from a dictionary definition. And this court continues, quote, this definition suggests that an act is a complete course of conduct. And then the court then concluded that the child's 20 separate assaults constituted 20 separate courses of conduct for which his parents were liable. That demonstrates that course of conduct, even in this court's own case law, that is not necessarily a series of acts, but can constitute a single completed act.
I want to follow up on Justice Rebecca Bradley's question and your response to her. And I appreciate that argument, and I found it very helpful. But it does feel a little different than what your briefing is, and that's why I just want to get a little bit of clarity from you, right? Because in some ways this case has moved into a discussion of what is a course of conduct, what is not a course of conduct. In some ways, the question that my colleague asked you was, the statutes point to, you know, has to be in connection with, and the confinement has to be, again, it also says after that, related to an offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced. So if you sign a signature bond, you're not in custody in connection with that particular crime for which you're ultimately sentenced. So statutorily, how can that, you know, how can that trigger? Yet in your briefing, and this is what I just want some clarity on, because I hear your argument being a little different, and that's fine, that happens sometimes, but I just want to make sure I understand your argument. In briefing, you said, to be clear, or you said, when an offender is free in a signature bond on one count, but is actually in custody at that time, Wisconsin courts have relied in part on the existence of the signature bond to deny credit. But then you say, to be clear, the state is not arguing that the fact of the posted signature bond in absence of an outstanding warrant are dispositive of his claim. Fermanic is not entitled to credit on count one because, as shown, his Oneida County custody does not satisfy the in connection with requirement. You go on and talk more about it. So it seems that your response to my colleague's question was, yes, actually, that is independently sufficient. That does appear to be different than your argument in the briefs. If so, that's fine. I just want to know.
Yeah. Just a little bit more background. It would be very helpful if this court were to say that that filing a signature bond is dispositive.
Well, wouldn't that read out, though? Don't you have a problem with the with course of conduct language? I mean, we're looking at the signature bond. All this has to say is for all days spent in custody for which sentence was imposed. Why would we ever go past that? You're either in a signature bond or a cash bond. Done.
Sure. Yes. So, the state had argued for many years that that cash bond alone signature bond alone was dispositive. And that would be very helpful if this court actually held that, because that, again, simplifies things greatly for attorneys, for judges, as they're dealing with this complicated issue. We understand it. Trial court judges understand that attorneys attempt to maximize the availability of credit if concurrent sentences are imposed by making sure that your bond statuses match up if you have multiple charges.
When was the bond set in, the cash bond set?
The cash bond was set, I believe, in October 1st, the day after the...
October 2, 2017.
Yeah, the day after the incidents.
Okay, and then when was the signature bond set?
Signature bond was set February 6, 2018.
So several months later.
Because they delayed bringing the charges, right?
Well,
yeah, he was not charged.
But when setting bond under 969-01, a court is required to determine whether or not the person will appear in court. Bail may be imposed at or after the initial appearance only upon a finding that there is a reasonable basis to believe the bail is necessary to assure the appearance in court. Now, given the cash bail and the non-release from cash bail, the court statutorily was required, really, to set a signature bond because the appearance in court was assured by the cash bail in Oneida. What, if anything, should we make of that?
I still think that defense attorneys, if they're thinking about the availability of credit, they may request a cash bond, even if it's a minor. Yeah.
If they want credit, they ask for cash bail.
Right.
Even though the appearance.
So I appreciate your argument that it would not be necessary if he's already in custody, and so perhaps it wouldn't satisfy the statute.
And he didn't have an attorney here to make that argument, though, so what do you make of that?
Well, we're not here on ineffective assistance.
Right. I have a question. Or failure to, I mean, is this a, he didn't receive his right to counsel case? Has anyone raised that as the reason why the whole thing should be unwound and he should go back for sentencing all over?
No, honestly, I mean, this is a state's appeal. And so there was a post-conviction motion that was filed here. Certainly he would be free to request other grounds on which to receive the same amount of credit later.
But if we were to determine that somehow he was inadequately constitutionally treated and deprived of his right to counsel, this should unwind the case differently, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't know that issue has been developed for this court.
It's not a credit case, then.
Please, go ahead. I have a question about the fairness argument or issue that has been raised, that it's somehow unfair that he was held in custody then for longer than what the court imposed as a sentence. But here, initially, until he was revoked from probation, the court withheld sentence on each count and imposed only 5 years of probation. So would it be unfair because he spent time in custody, quite a bit of time in custody, before he was sentenced?
No, this defendant received many chances, I think. This is only coming to us after a revocation proceeding. So I believe that the fairness arguments go both ways here. I see that my red light is on.
It is.
I'd ask that the court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
What I heard Attorney Whitworth say is that specific act means crime, that specific act means elements, and the legislature did not choose either of those terms. If the legislature meant to say, well, we want it to say crime, but we're going to choose course of conduct, that doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't they just choose crime? We're not here to decide the elements of the offense. We're here to decide what the course of conduct is.
This seems to me the rational reason for that would be because what crime you're actually charged with could morph or evolve. And so you'd want to use a little bit broader term to encompass the charges that could arise, because when you're initially held in custody, those may not be entirely clear.
Such as, like, a lesser-included offense?
Or other, you know, other charges that may be brought as more investigation is done into, you know, what exactly occurred. Maybe there's different related, you know, crimes that are charged with it.
Well, I would note that the court in Tuscher did discuss Boettcher, absolutely. I don't think this court needs to touch Boettcher at all. But Boettcher, the one example, the one factual example it gave for you know, why our legislature chose course of conduct instead of crime is, and I apologize for using the outdated term, but rape and battery. They cited a comment to the model penal code that said the person would still get credit because that's part of the same series of acts. Those are not the same specific act.
Counsel, you make reference to Boettcher, and I've read it a few times. And Tuchscher, of course, relies on Boettcher, and the Court of Appeals here relies on Tuchscher. So let's kind of turn back with me, if you will, to Boettcher. Boettcher defines what we're looking at here today, in part. It defines it by referencing the model code, and at page 93, in the language of the model code, it says, in the federal statute, in connection with the offense or acts for which sentence was imposed. And of course, the state statute has in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. I don't see Boettcher when it defines, when our court defined this language as being in connection with the offense or acts for which sentence was imposed, making reference to specific acts. So how does Tuchscher get to this language of specific acts? It's not in Boettcher. It's not in the statute. So can you help me with that?
The court does also read Beetz and say, you know, they also discuss the words truly related or identical. I think that that language also, you know, fed into the Tuchscher court's decision in interpreting that phrase. I don't know. I don't read Boettcher that way. Boettcher was a dual credit case. Yeah. It didn't endeavor to answer the question that we're talking about here. It just didn't. I want to say this, if the court accepts this rule that the state's proposing for the first time right now and says anytime there's a signature bond, no credit, the court's going to have to be prepared to overrule a lot of case law. Hence, there was a signature bond. Floyd, this court's decision in Floyd, there was a signature bond. Zaronis, which I guess the state is also saying was wrongly decided, would have to be overruled. That would be a large departure from the sentence credit jurisprudence, and I don't think the court should go that far and doesn't need.
It seems like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Counsel, in footnote 8 of the Court of Appeals opinion, it says, and I don't like double negatives, but here we go, while the state does not argue that Firmenich is not entitled to sentence credit because he was on signature bond. That's what footnote 8 and then goes on to say. Did you understand in the Court of Appeals the state was arguing signature bond as being dispositive? While the state does not argue that Firmenich is not entitled to the sentence credit because he was on signature bond. Has the argument changed here at all, or what's going on?
See, my red light is on. May I answer? I've always understood the state to be arguing that the signature bond is a huge problem. It means there's no direct connection between the custody and the sentence. So if he's going to get credit, he has to wind his way through counts 4 and 5 and prove that it's the same course of conduct. So I do think the states are always been arguing about the signature bond. I have not always been clear on whether it's dispositive or not, or just another reason. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for interesting oral argument. The court is set for us.